Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Well, it's time on the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Thursday, January 13th, 2022. I think it's the 13th. I've lost track of time. Here's the headline in the latest edition of the Chicago Tribune. It just popped into my little phone. Biden all but concedes defeat on voting election bills. Why am I a Democrat, ladies and gentlemen? Anyway, that's not really what I brought my distinguished guests on to discuss, but I got a feeling we'll work our way to that conversation eventually after we get some interesting tidbits of conversation out of the way. So without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself.
Hey, it's David Sirota. I am the publisher, founder of the Daily Poster, and I am a journalist, and I am the co-producer and co-story creator of the film Don't Look Up, which is has become the most successful film in Netflix's history in terms of viewing hours in its first week or two of release.
And he's also a good friend of the Ben Jarofsky Show, and at one point in his life actually co-wrote a story with me for the Reader many years ago.
Yes.
And I got to tell you something about co-writing a story with David Sirota. He doesn't play around. He kept pushing me. Come on, man. Not hard enough. Damn, I can understand what his co-workers with Don't Look Up must have gone through. If you treated them, David, anyway, you treated me harder. Hit them harder. And longtime listeners of the show also know we talk about you all the time, David. You're a longtime lefty, and you were a key aide to Bernie in his last presidential run. And I would love to take the deep dive on some of the political headlines of the day. Most of our people who listen to the show know you as a longtime strategist and writer and journalist, et cetera, and so forth, of the leftist persuasion. What they don't know, what we'll get out of the way first, because I find it fascinating, is that you have a deep and abiding love for movies. And anybody who sees the Daily Poster, a column written by David Sirota, will see a reference. Well, you're younger than me, so mostly 80s movies, 90s movies.
Right.
That's your wheelhouse. And so it's pretty clear that, like, when you want to make a metaphor, you know, almost like you'll instinctively go, like, in the movie, and then you'll have a scene from a movie. It's a common refrain in your journalism. So I know you love movies, but David, it caught me off guard about your involvement in Don't Look Up. So why don't you start at the beginning and tell folks how it came about that you were involved with such an important movie and a movie well worth watching. Go ahead.
Well, so Adam McKay, the director of the movie, director of great movies like Anchorman, Talladega Nights, Step Brothers, The Big Short, Vice, he and I have been friends for a long time. And he obviously has, if for folks to know, he has Chicago connections. He came out of Second City and the like, and maybe before, you know, early in his career, and he was a head writer of SNL. Adam and I have been friends for a long time, and after he did Vice, I said to him, hey, listen, you got to use your superpowers for comedy to do something about the climate crisis. And he said, yeah, I know, I've been trying to crack it, and I haven't been able to figure it out, and, you know, I just can't. I just don't know. I don't want to do a Mad Max kind of, dystopian movie. And we were going back and forth. And at one point I said, you know, the climate crisis feels like an asteroid's headed towards Earth and no one cares. And he said, you know, Mo, I wonder if maybe that's the movie, you know? And so we got to spitballing some scenes and ideas and characters and, and ultimately, essentially, one thing led to another, and out came the script from Adam McKay, and it's a great script, and I gave him notes, and the rest is history. The movie is about climate change, but it's also more deeply, I think, about whether we as a society can process basic facts anymore, or whether facts are now just cannon fodder in service of a partisan war, a media war, a culture war. In other words, do we even have the capacity to accept stipulated, verifiable scientific facts and act constructively on those facts? Or are facts now just a way we insult each other? Are facts things that we distract ourselves from? Are we even able to act rationally in the face of uncomfortable facts? And I think that's that's the essence of this movie.
Absolutely. I urge everybody to watch it. It's a great flick. And I say this, David, not just because I want to promote your career or anything, but it is a great flick. My wife and I watched it. And I'm an old-time movie guy. I go way back, obsessively watching movies. I think I'm watching Inside Man now for the 12th time in my life. Certain movies I love more than others. Well, you asked a question. Now answer that question. I don't want to give away too much of the movie, though I have a feeling that everybody who's listening has seen it. As you said, it's one of the most popular movies in the history of Netflix. But you asked a question. Now answer it. Can we have a rational conversation in our country around certain accepted facts?
I think the answer is in question. I think at times it feels like we can't. At times it feels like the discussion is we're trying to he said, she said everything. Everybody can be in their own information silo. Everybody can bring so-called alternative facts. I think that ideology means we don't want to accept certain facts. Some people see this movie, they think it's a pandemic movie about the science of vaccines, the science of virus pandemics. And I think a lot of times it feels like we just refuse to just stipulate, yes, this is a fact. I think in the climate debate, more and more people have stipulated that the climate is changing. So that's good. That's becoming more accepted, not 100%, but more. But now the debate is, okay, well, if the climate's changing and it's dangerous, here are the things that we can do to fix it. And we can't really even yet agree that we can or should do those things. And so I worry about that you have a climate crisis that really isn't political at all. It's not. It's just math. It's just physics. It's just biology. And yet it is seen as a political issue, quote unquote. And it shouldn't be a political issue. It's climate change is political in the same way water is political or the same way air is political. Climate change is not political. It's just a thing. It's a phenomenon. And the fact that it has become, quote unquote, political just suggests that basic facts, basic science is now just another piece of artillery or ammunition in the political war. And that's really problematic because climate change doesn't care about people's political ideology. It doesn't care about the current state of politics right now. It doesn't care about, it doesn't have the capacity to care. It's just a thing. And so what I worry about is that we're still debating things that are undebatable while the crisis gets worse and worse. And so the hope is that the movie, people watch the movie and they feel grabbed by the lapels and they hear a truth or a set of truths about our society that I think most people know to be true in their hearts, but we rarely ever say out loud, which is that our information system, our way of dealing with facts is completely foobar and needs to change.
I just dealt with this on a very local level here in the city of Chicago, where I opined in a column that the mayor of the city of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, does not in fact believe the ridiculous things she's been saying in her confrontation with the Chicago Teachers Union over COVID protocol in the schools, but that in fact she just is saying them to defend herself against things that can't be defended or to win points in a larger political battle with the teachers union. And that leads me to this question. Do you think that's become the position of so many people in this country that they say things like in terms of denying climate change or denying that vaccines are necessary to protect us from COVID? Are they saying them just to win points in a larger political battle? Or do you think they actually believe things that are not true?
I think sometimes it's a mix of those things. I think sometimes politicians especially don't like to think of themselves as villains. They don't like to think of themselves as corrupt. So if you hand them a politically convenient set of rationales, no matter how divorced from the actual truth they are, a politically convenient set of rationales to justify behavior that's easy for them, they will glom onto that, whether it's truthful or not. In other words, if a politician doesn't, if it's easier for a politician in the power analysis to take a certain position, they don't want to think of themselves as Dr. Evil for taking that position. So if there's a rationale out there that they can glom onto to say, hey, I'm not being Dr. Evil here. I'm just being, you know, here's this ridiculous argument. That's really why I'm doing this. It makes them feel better. It makes them feel like they're serving the public. Even when they're not. And so, you know, I think the problem is that a lot of politicians don't want to take risks. And a lot of politicians really don't want to take risks when it comes to challenging power. I mean, most politicians who are corrupt, again, they don't see themselves as corrupt. They say, oh, you know, I didn't vote for the provision to lower drug prices in America, even though drug prices are rapaciously high in the United States. I voted against that because I want to make sure that there's still good research and development for drugs. And the drug companies supposedly have to make this amount of money that they make off of the American public in order to fund that research and development. Meanwhile, that politician may be getting tens of thousands of dollars from drug company CEOs in terms of campaign contributions. But they want to believe that they're actually behaving in the public interest when they're voting against the public interest. That's a way to comfort themselves that I'm not just selling out here. I'm a good guy. Keeping drug prices in America is, I'm the good guy here. I'm the hero, right? I mean, I think that's actually how it psychologically works for most of the most corrupt people in the government and in the country, that they do not see themselves as villains, that they have come up with prepackaged rationales provided to them by the industries that they are shilling for, that they take those rationales and they internalize them. Because nobody wants to wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and see Dr. Evil. They want to see Superman.
So people effectively brainwash themselves. Our leaders have effectively brainwashed themselves. It doesn't matter if in their heart of hearts they actually believe what they're saying. The reality is they're never going to
be more comfortable.
Yeah.
They're more likely, if somebody gives, if a corporate interest gives them a way to brainwash themselves that makes their decision to take the easy road, the lucrative road, the self-enriching road, the less risky political road for themselves, they are more likely to take on that thought process because it's self-soothing. It doesn't make them come face to face with the fact that they're a horrible person.
I'm thinking, again, going back to Chicago, just Lori Lightfoot insisting that the only thing driving her was her the reality that children need to be in school and you have to keep them in school, as opposed to a debate over whether the schools themselves were safe. But it gets to the point you're making. In the movie,
and I think on that issue, if I can just sort of
go ahead,
I don't know the details of what's going on in Chicago, but I think that's also a situation where, and this is what I'm frustrated about just in the pandemic, which is that, science does not offer us 100% answers. And I think an infantilized America and infantilized politicians want binary answers. Yes, it's safe. No, it's not safe. And science, that's just not the way the world works. It's not the way science works. It's not way the way the world works. And I think that on the schools issue, as an example, there are no easy answers. You're going to make a sacrifice either way. You're either going to keep the kids in school or you're going to close the schools. And each of those comes with good parts and bad parts. And there just is no simple answer to that question. And I think, I believe in standing with the teachers. I think teachers are heroes. I think that, I think when their union votes to do something on behalf of safety, that is something that should be respected. I'm not saying, you can't question it. You can't, ask respectful or even respectfully disagree with it, but you should respect that process. And I think that the fact that situations like that become so polarized, so us versus them, is actually a really sad commentary on exactly what, in a sense, the movie is about, that we can't have a civil, rational debate and discussion about a set of difficult circumstances. There is no right answer when it comes to something like this. There just isn't. Or I should put it this way. I have my views on what I think can happen, and you have your views on what you think can happen, and everybody can have their own views on that. But there's no, my answer is 1,000% correct and your answer is completely wrong. That's just not how the world and not how science or how a pandemic works. And I think we don't want to accept that.
I was gonna correct you one thing about your own movie. In your own movie, there is one situation
that
is 100%. There is this comet coming to the Earth, and it will destroy Earth unless we do something to impede its progress. There's no
Let me add something to that.
Yeah,
the way that relates to the point I just made is that the movie is an allegory, which essentially the allegory is effectively saying, even when there is a situation where there is no debate, right? Because most situations, arguably, there's there can be a debate, it doesn't break down, yes or no. But even in situations where there is a clearly something is happening and we need to do something about it, even in those situations, we can't behave in a rational, civil way.
All right. I want you to address criticism I've seen leveled at the movie. I could address it myself, but I'd much rather hear you do it. And I've read this from people of the centrist persuasion many times. Centrist persuasion people have great access to the mainstream media. And they criticize the movie because, as they put it, it's preaching to the choir. And that the only people who will be moved by this movie are people who already believe in what Sirota believes or what Adam McKay believes or what DiCaprio believes or Jennifer Lawrence, et cetera, and so forth. the people who made the movie. So I'd love to get your response to that criticism. And then the obvious follow-up is, how do you get people to change their worldview if they disagree with you? But let's deal with the criticism itself. You're just preaching to the choir, Sirota. You should have been preaching to people more like me.
Well, so first of all, I would call that, in a word, horseshit, in the sense that it's at best prognostication. It is a belief by the people arguing that, but it's not based on any empirical reality at all. I can tell you anecdotally, granted it's only anecdotal, but anecdotally, we've heard from a lot of people who say their family members are conservative or Republican, and they really appreciated the movie as well. It's gotten viewed by tens of millions, I think more than 100 million people. So the idea that it's only 100 million, you know, left of center people, that's just ridiculous. But I also think about that argument. There's an inherent smug elitism in that argument, which is to say that the people saying that, oh, you're only preaching to your choir, and I'm sure without any evidence at all, that people who don't necessarily agree with you on everything won't understand, internalize, or be moved by this message. That's fundamentally elitist. How do you know that? And what does it say about your view of people you disagree with? Right? What it says is you think they're too stupid, too ignorant, too hostile to basic truths in this movie to get anything out of it. And I just reject that. I mean, this movie is a fundamentally, in my view, populist movie. That is to say that there are universal truths in this movie. Some people are going to hate the movie. Some people are going to love the movie. I don't think you have to agree with my particular politics to take things away from this movie, to see the truisms in this movie. I'm just not that much of an elitist to believe that you have to agree with my politics to see the universal truths in this movie. And I think the people who are making that argument are really showing their whole ass. They're showing their own elitism about how they view people they disagree with.
In general, do you think you can change people's minds in the culture? Because so much of what you started off by saying is that we're locked in this horrific situation where people believe can't even agree on certain facts. Have you lost confidence in your ability as a journalist, a writer, to get people who start off disagreeing with you to use your powers of persuasion and logic to get them to agree with you?
Yes, I have lost faith in that. I've lost faith in the idea that if you report facts, that those facts will be judged on their merits. I have had multiple experiences as a reporter. This is separate from the movie. Multiple experiences as a reporter where you report facts, and depending on who the facts that you've reported serve, those facts get touted by one political side and vilified by another political side. And it's switched sides all the time. We did this big story on in 2016 on Hillary Clinton and her decisions on arms deals and how the country's benefiting from arms deals that the State Department was approving. We're also giving money to the Clinton Foundation. This story was touted by conservative right wingers, and it was vilified by Democrats, Democratic people on social media, Democratic pundits. Then we reported on a story on Donald Trump and him essentially abusing the fine print to rip off his own investors. This story was touted by Democrats and liberals, and it was vilified by right-wingers. And the point being that what was depressing about that to me as a journalist is, hey, listen, I just reported facts that nobody is disputing. These are facts that literally not anybody, they're not my opinion, they're grounded in documents, and you're mad based on your political affiliation. You're mad at the story or you love the story. You're not mad at the politician or mad about the facts on their merits. And so that is a really, truly depressing thing about being a journalist today. That is not why I went into journalism. And it hasn't deterred me from continuing to do journalism, but it is super depressing to know that no matter how good a story you report out, it will be filtered through a kind of media ecosystem that is represented in the movie and received based on different camps and how they view it to serve their own political interests, rather than what the facts are actually saying about what's going on in our world. And that is depressing. Now, I do think as an asterisk here, I do think comedy can be a place that delivers persuasive messages. I do think that our movie does deliver really universal truths that I think that the comedy, in a sense, it allows people to laugh at the things that we know are true and bad that we don't usually explicitly talk about. And so the hope is that the comedy part of this movie is part of what persuades people to realize what the problem is and be more aware of that and ultimately move them into action, move them into at least acceptance of the idea that there are facts in the world and they should be respected.
Well, one of the things most funny about the movie is its depiction of the media. And the media looks bad, David, in pretty much every movie. Even in a movie is not explicitly about the media. I make fun of this all the time, but whenever there's a scene in a movie where one of the leading character has to go through that mob of reporters, and the reporters just, they're just yelling at them. They look, any movie, TV show, they look the worst. It's just yelling questions out as they go. They don't, it's become such a stock image. So the media does not look good at pretty much in any movie, but in your movie, Adam McKay, this guy is just continuing his great tradition of making fun of media. And I, he's really on, like, it goes back to Anchorman, really. The hosts, Tyler Perry, the host of that morning talk show, man, did you guys capture that to a T? Like that bubble-headed giggling thing they do, to reduce every issue to something that you could joke about and laugh about because you don't want to take anything seriously. You don't want to offend anybody. I thought that was right on.
It's one of my favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah.
The Daily Rip. Yeah, that's what we call it, the Daily Rip. It's one of my favorite parts of the movie. And I think, it rings universally true. That is, you watch that and it's familiar and funny because you see it every day if you flip on morning television. And I think when it comes to something like the climate crisis, it's just that model, that method, that format, it's just not up to the task of helping us realize and act on a crisis that is threatening our world.
By the way, have you heard from any like morning show hosts about the depiction in the movie? Has anybody got back to you and said, Schroeder, that was really a cheap shot, or you really got us good?
No. I mean, I know that Tyler Perry, I believe I read that he talked to a couple of these folks to help get himself into character. So I think that's why it's so real is, I mean, Tyler Perry and Cate Blanchett, what an amazing job they did at capturing that. It really didn't feel forced at all. It felt, and that's actually the thing I'm so proud of about the movie is that, the movie I think has generated so much conversation because it's only like one click away from reality. It's not 5-10 clicks away from reality, right? It's not so ridiculous that you can't imagine it. In fact, what I think has freaked some people out is that it really is very close to reality. I mean, there's this idea in science fiction called the uncanny valley. The uncanny valley is this idea about how when a human being sees a robot that's too human-like, a little too human-like, it freaks out. a human being. There's something innate that we get freaked out about, something that's not so fake that you know it's fake, but something that's not it's one little bit away from real. It just freaks us out. And I think this movie, I think part of the reason why it's gotten such a strong reaction is because it really is in the uncanny valley. I've heard people say, oh, that was the best documentary I ever saw. And I think that's what freaks people out. You watch this movie and you're like, that's exactly how it would go down if a comet was headed towards Earth. That is not an overstatement. That is really how it would go.
Oh, absolutely. And I know you were... I actually do not know. I do not know this. I said I know you, and then I did not know this. If the COVID debate had already played out by the time you and Adam McKay got around to spitballing ideas about the movie, because it's a perfect metaphor or a parable for the COVID debate. We're instinctively...
Well, we started spitballing this before COVID was even on the radar. And then, as Adam has said, COVID hit, and they had to tweak the script to make it 15% even more insane, because reality's insanity was catching up with the parody and satire of the movie.
Well, let's just think about this. So the position that Donald Trump is in, so we could talk COVID. So Donald Trump wants full credit for creating the vaccine. Okay, the guy who told you to inject bleach wants credit for creating the vaccine. At the same time, he does not want to alienate his core supporters by saying you must take the vaccine. Even though he'll say this is saving the world and you should take it, he doesn't want to go the next step and say you must take it, because mandates, and this is what he said in the latest interview, mandates are the biggest problem we face in our country. Now, I'm like, that in itself is such bizarre satire. How could you and McKay get together and make it any more bizarre than that huge, giant mixed message that Donald Trump is trying to get people to ingest? And it could hurt him, David, politically speaking, to take too much credit for the vaccine. That's how insane things are right now. So, yes, I think you're absolutely correct when you say... in some ways, the reality has outpaced your movie.
100%. And I think the entire discourse around the vaccine has absolutely, it's just so insane. And by this, I mean, I have a member of my family who works in and around healthcare facilities. And to hear that person talk about what's going on inside of healthcare facilities right now with COVID, to hear the reality of what's going on versus in contrast to the political conversation, the media conversation about the vaccine and about the pandemic. I mean, it's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying, and it's horrifying in this way that. The vaccine is a miracle of science. Any rational physician, scientist will tell you it is a miracle that our government was able to create so quickly with so much basic research that had been done prior, that we were able to create this life-saving vaccine. And while I'm not weighing in on whether people should be forced to take the vaccine, I am weighing in on the idea that this is a good thing, that if we cannot agree that the creation of a life-saving vaccine is a good thing, to paraphrase the movie, then something has gone deeply wrong in our society, and that the selective outrage about this vaccine versus other things that happen in our healthcare system is just even more insane. In other words, there are people who are upset about the vaccine, insist that it is unproven. It's not. make all these wild claims about the vaccine, and then are also enthusiastic about experimental treatments and taking ivermectin or whatever other therapy. Like, yeah. It's so selective. Like, you think this vaccine is actually peer-reviewed and proven to work, may not be perfect. It may not have no side effects for a small number of people. Science doesn't give us perfection, but you're very upset about this vaccine, and yet you're incredibly certain that ivermectin or bleach or whatever is gonna, like, that doesn't, that's what we're talking about here. It's like, I'm not going to accept things that are peer-reviewed facts, and then I'm just gonna. So it would be one thing to say, I'm not going to accept any fact. I'm not going to accept ivermectin. I'm not going to accept the vaccine. I'm not going to accept any of it. I mean, at least that's consistent. But the contradictory behavior where somehow the peer-reviewed science of the vaccine is not credible, but some idiot on YouTube saying ivermectin is the cure, somehow that's an indisputable fact. I mean, that is the crazy thing that we're talking about here. And that is what's so disturbing when you talk to, you know, this member of my family who's in the healthcare field, you know, how it can drop people who are living this on the front lines. They are being driven insane by seeing the real world effects of that insanity in the hospital, in the nursing homes, to see the insanity of the world that we present in Don't Look Up vis-a-vis the pandemic. Oh, I'm not going to accept the vaccine. Give me bleach. I don't believe the science. Give me ivermectin. Then to see people dying because of that, literally watching human beings die. Imagine the experience of that. And that's what really depresses me. I mean, that really, I don't even know how to process that. It's just, it's maddening.
Yeah, I hear you. And it is bewildering. And by the way, very interesting choice of words. You were talking, our government, you said, came up with this miracle vaccine. You didn't give credit to Pfizer. You didn't give credit to Johnson & Johnson. You didn't give credit to any of the big pharma companies that have actually, quote unquote, producing it or making gazillions off of it. You gave credit to our government. Talk about that distinction, using our government as opposed to the pharmaceutical companies that are that manufacture it and are distributing it.
Look, I'm not taking away credit that private companies participated in this, but I'm also saying that the basic science, basic research around these vaccines and more broadly around medicines in this country, that comes from our government. I mean, there was a study a couple of years ago that found, I think it was every major FDA-approved drug from, I think it was 2010 to 2016, every single one, the basic research of that had been funded by the federal government through the NIH. This is a part of America that we just don't even talk about, which is that the drug companies tout the idea that they need to make giant outsized profits, bigger profits here than they make anywhere else, in order to fund their research and development. Meanwhile, the federal government, aka you, me, and the entire public, are actually the ones funding the basic research, which is then handed over to the drug companies for them to profit off of not just worldwide, but profit off of, in the biggest possible way compared to anyone else, profit off of Americans who originally paid for the research and development. Another way to put it is, we, the public, did the riskiest research at the beginning. That's the financially riskiest research because it's early on in the process. You know, you're going to dig a lot of dry holes, to use a oil metaphor there. You're going to look in the wrong places a lot. But we, the public, funded that research. That's risky research. And then when we discover something, we give it away to private companies. There was a rule on the books that said the companies, when they get that research, there used to be a rule that said you have to offer it to Americans at a fair and reasonable price, because we, the Americans, already paid. We de-risked it for you. We paid for the research. Okay, you didn't have to pay for that. So in return for our risky investment, you have to offer the final product to us at fair and reasonable prices. In the Clinton administration, that was rescinded. It was a huge win for the drug companies, brought to you by the Clinton administration, and drug prices since then have skyrocketed because the drug companies get the best of all worlds. They're in a country with no price controls. They're in a country whose government funds most of their research. So they get cheap research or subsidized research that they can turn into a product that they can offer to the public, and they can be given a monopoly patent, so there's no price competition, and they don't have to offer it at any fair and reasonable price in the United States. And Medicare can't even use its bulk purchasing power to negotiate lower prices. I mean, that is the sweetest deal you could possibly imagine if you're a pharmaceutical company. I mean, this just does not get better if you're the CEO of a major drug company. It's the worst in the world for the population because we just got fleeced like three different ways. We invested the money to give them the research. We pay the highest prices for the final product. And there's no price competition because we gave them monopoly patents.
Well put. It just adding to the fuel of my anti-Clinton fervor. I think the last time you were on the show, we were talking about that in regards to Rahm Emanuel. Just as with each passing day, I get more upset with Bill Clinton and his administration, and then mad at myself because I voted for him twice. Every time he was on the ballot, I voted for him. So I guess it's my fault. All right, before I get too depressed about the role I played in politics, in electing these people, let's get you to comment on the news that I began the show with before we close it down. And that, of course, is that the voting rights bill, it seems like it has hit the wall because Kyrsten Sinema, the senator from Arizona, has announced that there's no way that she could possibly, in good conscience, agree to weaken the filibuster in the Senate. And that we need to encourage as much as possible bipartisanship, even though there are no Republicans on the bill. And there's no way it will pass. And she says she wants to pass it unless we get rid of the filibuster. This is madness, David Sirota. Not as bad as looking the other way as the earth is about to be blown up by a meteor. But in that direction, in my humble opinion, your take on this latest development.
Well, first of all, I find it very revealing that you don't simultaneously see Kyrsten Sinema campaigning in Republican states to pressure Republicans to support voting rights. So, in other words, that's a tell that this is all a game. Oh, I support it. I want the Republicans to support it, but I'm not going to even lift a finger to try to get them to support it. So it's really to me, it's like it's a tell. This is a person who thinks this is all a game. I also have a larger concern, criticism of the entire way this thing has played out. The Democrats focusing on voting rights, in absence of delivering permanent economic benefits to an economically pulverized working class, to me, it just says so much about what this party believes and doesn't believe. And what I'm trying to say here is the public has been voting for change for the last, I would argue, since 2006, the anti-Bush congressional race, then of course 2008, the public keeps voting for change. The public keeps using the democratic process to vote for change. And the democratic process, small d democratic process, keeps producing more of the same. And so the idea that the democracy crisis is merely a crisis of people not having their votes counted or becoming harder to vote. I'm all for voting rights. I'm all for protecting voting rights, of course. But my point is that the democracy crisis, first and foremost, is a crisis of a nominally Democratic government refusing to give the public what it wants. And so voting rights, in absence of actually delivering policy change, is almost feels performative. That it that the formula of the Democratic Party, in my view, and it was back in FDR's day, he talked about this explicitly, that essentially you have to show that a Democratic government will deliver real benefits, not just for its corporate donors, but for voters, that if you show people that, they're more likely to care about and believe in democracy. They're more likely to believe their vote matters. That voting rights, in absence of delivering for voters, suggests that the voting process unto itself is performative. It's this thing that we do. It's like a ceremony, but it doesn't actually necessarily matter. And so, I mean, there's this famous quote that FDR said, you know, he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, a lot of this is back in the 30s. Advanced countries have decided to not be democratic anymore, not because their people didn't want the right to self-governance, but because they saw a dysfunctional government and they decided to sacrifice liberty in the name of getting something to eat. That right-wing opportunists, authoritarians promised them that, hey, you may not have democracy, but I'm going to deliver for you. And that, to me, that's the real democracy crisis in America. And what's the tell here is that the Democratic Party is pushing for voting rights in absence of delivering real help to millions of people because its donor class doesn't feel threatened by voting rights. That you have to understand the Democratic Party at this point, unfortunately, as an entity that will only do things that do not offend its donors. And the problem with that is that the corporate donor class, you cannot solve problems, real problems in America, and also appease and satisfy the donor class that is creating those problems. So voting rights, in absence of actually challenging the donor class and delivering for working people, is a kind of a formula that admits that they're just not willing to actually address the real democracy crisis, which is a government in the people's name that refuses to deliver for people.
Wow. That was a great riff, David. I took notes and I'm probably going to steal all your ideas and not give you any credit in a column.
Well, please do.
Because everything you said applies to Chicago in so many levels, really, in so many ways. All right, David Sirota, it's a blast talking to you always. The last time we were on, we were predicting that Rahm Emanuel will be confirmed as ambassador to Japan, even though it's a disgrace. It happened. He is heading off to Japan as we speak. He's probably somewhere in the air flying. And but nonetheless, it was a good fight. So thank you for joining that fight. It was an utter disgrace that the Dems would nominate this guy to be their ambassador. And I'm sure there'll be other fights in the future that will require me to reach out to you, bring you on the show and discuss them. And it's always a blast talking to you, David. So thanks for taking the time to talk to us right now.
Thanks, man. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. That's the great David Sirota. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.